Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Cindy F. Solomon coming to you today on May 14th at 4 o'clock Pacific Time with the Global Product Management Talk. The Global Product Management Talk is curated for product professionals who can't leave their desks to engage in product talks on a regular basis. It's a weekly mini product camp Socratic discussion of pre-posted questions with live audio of thought leader and co-host commenting via live broadcast. You are listening now. Welcome. For more information on how to participate with us, go to www.prodmgmttalk.com to view the FAQs. And to follow us on Twitter, use the hashtag #PRODMGMTTALK and follow us now at Prod Management Talk. I'm excited to be with you today with Brian Lawley, our speaker, and Nick Koster, our co-host. We're brought to you this week by the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, the AIPMM, which is the hub of all things product management. It's where product professionals go for answers, the world's largest professional organization of product managers, brand managers, product marketing managers, and other individuals responsible for guiding their organizations and clients through a constantly changing business landscape. It is the only organization that represents those who manage the entire product lifecycle throughout any industry. For more information, please visit www.aipmm.com. Today, we are talking about the 7-phase standard product lifecycle, what you must know for your product to succeed. How can businesses make their products dramatically more successful? There is a process that companies can implement to ensure success and avoid disastrous mistakes commonly made. There are critical decisions that must be made in order for a product to succeed. If you ignore these decisions, you risk product failure. By understanding the 7 phases that every product passes through, product managers can guarantee that shipped products will better meet customers' needs and deliver increased revenues and profits. Our speaker today is Brian Lawley. Brian is a CEO and founder of the 280 Group. He is the author of 5 product management and marketing books, The Phenomenal Product Manager, Expert Product Management, 42 Rules of Product Management, 42 Rules of Product Marketing, and The Optimal Product Process. Brian is a former president of the Silicon Valley Product Management Association, and he was awarded the Association of International Product Marketing and Management Award for Thought Leadership in Product Management. He's the editor of the Product Management 2.0 blog and newsletter, and also writes guest articles for publications such as the Software Development Forum newsletter, SoftLetter, and the SVPMA newsletter. He is a prolific evangelist for product management excellence. We are pleased today to give a copy of each of his books for people who are tweeting. If you are tweeting today, you will be eligible to win one of his books. Our co-host today is Nick Koster. Nick Koster is the co-founder of BrainMates, who is passionate about the benefits of putting the customer before the technology and building products and services that delight the buyer and user. Nick has been developing and managing products for over 13 years. With a range of different companies, including Telstra, Big Pond, Excite at Home, Optus, Westpac, and eBay, delivering internet service and telecommunications, online applications, and internet security products. In the process of this journey, he has developed a deep understanding of the way the different technologies fit together, and he's always amazed at the new and exciting ways that people use them. So great, and I am Cindy F. Solomon. You can find out all about me at cindyfsolomon.com. This past weekend, I attended Product Camp Utah. There was also a Product Camp Portland going on at the same time. If you're interested in viewing the tweets and the content from both of those, you can go over to stirify.com/PRODMGMTTALK, where you can read the curated content from both events. Product Camp Utah was the second product camp that they've had in less than a year, and they're planning another one in September. It was exciting for me to find out that Erica Anderson, who's been a past co-host and speaker, actually started Product Camp Utah from attending this very talk. She was inspired by so much learning, and there she is in the tweet. She's out in the Twittersphere. Hi, Erica. She was inspired to find out more about product management from participating weekly here. She joined us at Product Camp Silicon Valley and then went back to Utah and started it up with some other great product managers, Michael Hopkins and Travis Jensen, who has also been a speaker here. It was a great event. Really excited and delighted to have Brian here of the 280 Group. As I said, he's a prolific speaker and educator, and the 280 Group has some excellent, excellent content and training.
Well, hello, and thanks everyone for listening, and thanks, Cindy, for having me as a guest. I've been following what you've been doing for a long time and very excited to be involved and be here today. What I'll be talking about today is the seven-phase product life cycle, and it's a concept that was developed by the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, AIPMM, in conjunction with a number of companies and experts in the field of product management. The 280 Group was heavily involved in developing it, and we support it in our materials, in our training, in our product management certifications, and also in our toolkits and our templates. Now, the life cycle is a seven-phase life cycle, and one thing I should mention is if you'd like a copy of my book, Optimal Product Process, and you want to read more about the seven phases and the 280 Group Optimal Product Process built on top of it, you can go to the 280 Group website, and under services, at the bottom of the services menu, there's a menu item about Optimal Product Process, and you can download a free ebook and watch a webinar on it. That's a way to get a copy of the visual that shows the actual process. So what I want to do first is just kind of talk you through the basics of what the overall seven-phase life cycle is, and then we'll get a little more into the optimal product process that's built on top of it. So the seven phases that are in the life cycle are conceive, plan, develop, qualify, launch, market, and then end of life. And every product and every service goes through these, goes through each one of these phases, although in many cases companies are not conscious of what the phases are, and oftentimes they'll miss some of the details or they won't be thinking about upcoming phases and planning accordingly. I'll give you a simple example of that. During the qualify phase, it's very common for companies to be far in development and not be planning on getting the product into the hands of a lot of users before they go live. And I know one company that was a Bluetooth headset maker, and they cut short. They ended up not putting their product in the hands of lots of users out in the marketplace before they released it officially. And it turns out they launched the product. They spent a couple $1 million marketing it. And it turned out that the product in something like 85% of the cases did not work. So they had to actually give refunds for all those headsets that they shipped. So the first phase of the seven is called conceive. And conceive is really where you generate and prioritize your ideas. So you work with your team as a product manager. You work with all the different inputs you have, your engineers who have great innovative ideas, your salespeople, your executives who oftentimes have a pet feature they want to add. You work with your technical support people. Of course, you work with your customers and your channel. You sometimes work with press and analysts, or you sometimes work with strategic partners. And during conceive, that's really when you want to gather all of the different ideas, whether it's features for a particular product or whether it's different types of products that you might want to come up with. So say you have ideas for seven or eight different new products. What you want to do during the conceive phase is get enough of a sketch of them made in terms of what the content is and what the service or the product is going to be. You want to do some prioritization around strategic fit, around size of market, around your ability as a company to deliver based on your core competencies. And then once you've prioritized that, you want to take the top one, or in some cases more than one, idea, and you really want to go out and do some additional stuff. You want to validate the concept with customers, and you want to do some preliminary versions of, for instance, the business case. You want to do enough of a business case to know whether or not you can move from that conceived section into actual planning, where you have a full-time person on it who's actually doing the planning. You can bring engineering resources on it, et cetera. So after conceive is plan.
So excuse me, Brian. So are all the activities that corporations go through around innovation and crowdsourcing and research and development, do those fall within conceive?
Yeah, they would fall within conceive, and then some of them fall in terms of inside of plan. For instance, if you have an existing product, you're not coming up with new product concepts, But what you might be doing is coming up with new features, and doing crowdsourcing or doing other activities like that can really help you in the planning phase, where you're going to really look at what your roadmap looks like, overall what your feature prioritization should be for the next release and releases following that, et cetera. And during the planning phase, you create a market needs or a market requirements document, and then a corresponding product description document. And I should mention that there are 8 key documents across the entire 7 phases, and I'll talk a little bit more about each one of them. But we have a product called the Product Management Lifecycle Toolkit that has all 8 documents and explains the process overall. And the idea behind the documents isn't so much to sit down and write them. In some cases, you may want to document things very extensively, depending on your company. And in other cases, you may want to just simply look at the documents and make sure that at each phase, the key questions you need to be asking for success are really being addressed. Also, during the plan phase, you're going to want to do a sketch of a roadmap, what your product's going to look like going out in the next few years, and where you think the competition's going to be, just to do a reality check about whether you believe you can win strategically in the marketplace. Coming out of plan is the develop phase, and this is when you really start the core development of the product. You make the tough feature and schedule trade-offs. You work very closely with your engineers. You work very closely with your customers to get answers to tough questions. And I should mention that the 7-phase product lifecycle looks like a waterfall process. It has the 7-phase gate in between each. But it can also apply to agile development. And in agile, you're basically going through the first 4 or 5 phases much more rapidly and doing smaller development sections. The fourth phase then is qualify, when you're going to do your customer test, obviously doing your internal testing, and just making sure the product is high enough quality. And given the features, if you had to cut features, is the product going to be competitive and really win in the marketplace? The fifth phase that comes after qualifying is launching the product. And really the goal of the launch is to generate as much awareness as possible and get feedback on the product, and also help you in terms of getting feedback on what you think should go in the next version, or at least early feedback, and what needs to be changed. It could be that you only need to change a few things to make the product far more successful.
But you said, what was the primary goal of the launch?
The primary goal is usually to generate as much awareness as possible for the product so that you get a very positive image out there and you generate enough leads to get you the revenue that you want. There are exceptions to that, however. One would be if you decide to do a soft launch where the product either isn't completely ready or want to get it out to just a limited set of customers and get some feedback because you're not sure if the feature set is perfect. So we have a whole module on product launches. We have a product launch toolkit that talks about all the different types of launches and goals and so on. But usually the goal of launch is get the product out and get as much awareness as possible. And then the final two phases, after launch comes market, and that's when the product's out in the marketplace. You're going to be running your marketing programs, monitoring them, looking at return on investment, and also gathering additional feedback for that next version of the product. And then lastly is retire. This is a phase that many companies forget about until they end up having a major problem. Because if you retire a product the wrong way, it's very possible that you can make your customer base very, very angry and also damage your brand. Retiring products, in some cases, it's very simple. You're able to just simply stop producing the products. If it's a physical product, you stop shipping it through the channels. But in many cases, you have to figure out how are you going to support your older customers and for how long? What are you going to do with all the product that's in the channel or the product that's committed to customers or the features and other enhancements you've committed to customers? And the 7-phase cycle, as I mentioned, it covers everything from the whole idea of, okay, let's come up with a great idea and conceive, all the way to, okay, we're ready to retire this. And retirement can either be retiring the product for good with no other versions, or it could be you're retiring a 1.0 product because you're about to launch a 2.0 product. So on top of the 7-phase product lifecycle, the 280 Group has built what's called the optimal product process. And the optimal product process is basically a way to think about how responsibilities are divided up among product management and product marketing along the seven phases. And then also in terms of what documents are critical as you're going through, or what decisions are critical as you're going through the seven phases. So we like to think of it as product management, their sort of role in life, their charter, is to build great products, to build products that really delight customers. And if they do what's right, they'll have a strategy and they'll have a product and a combination that can win in the marketplace and provide the strategic and the financial incentives or results that the company's looking for. One thing I'd encourage everyone to do is, on the 280 Group website, there's a resource section called Resource Central. It's one of the main menu items. And under it, there's a section about the profession of product management. And there's a piece that I wrote in there called the Product Management Manifesto that's been very, very popular. I wrote it and got feedback from thousands of people on LinkedIn and other places. And I think it's a really excellent, concise way to summarize what a product manager's sort of mission in life is, or mission in their company is. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that and download it. The product manager is responsible for a number of the key decisions and also a number of the key documents, if you will. The business case initially, you know, is there a market? Is the market big enough? Can we reach it? What's it going to cost? What's a basic profit and loss going to look like? And in some companies, this is as simple as sitting down and having a 20-minute meeting with the founder. Everyone looks at the numbers, and you're excited enough that you decide to commit resources. In other companies, you may have a very lengthy process and may have to go to great lengths to really justify what you're doing. And then in other cases, there are some companies that have sort of a hybrid model. Adobe Systems is a good example. They were a client of ours for several years, and they have a sort of office of innovation, and where anyone in the company can decide if they believe they have a great product idea, they can go through this standardized program, and once a quarter, everyone gets to pitch their products, you know, with a standard business case, et cetera, and they're all compared, and management then decides which ones they're going to fund. The product manager is also responsible for creating the market needs document, where the market requirements and personas and use cases and customer problems are all documented. And the idea behind that document is really to state what customers are going through, what problems are we really solving, as opposed to providing specific solutions.
So this is the, did you say the MRD?
Yeah, it's referred to as an MRD, market requirements document, or we call it the market needs document, because we think market needs represents more of what you're trying to convey in that particular document.
So, Nick, we've talked about this before, the business case. So is the business case a shortened version of the MRD, or does it have a different purpose?
I think depending on where you go around the world, we all talk about the same things in slightly different ways. I think the way we approach the business case is the justification for, firstly, the first cut of a business case is a justification for developing the MRD or the market needs document. I think that's pretty much the way Brian's described it as well.
When we look at that
very first idea and sort of do that conceive phase, the next part of the planning is then to provide a little bit more rigor and some analytics around the idea that was conceived, make sure it still makes sense, make sure there's a sufficient market to explore, and then essentially have enough information to fund the research piece to then build out the personas and look at the user scenarios. And the reason why I think this is a great model to try and provide that resourcing is that in a lot of the product management teams that we work with, the process of creating personas and exploring user scenarios is not specifically funded at all. It's done on a shoestring, and as a result, it's done quite often poorly, not through any lack of will of the product manager, but simply because the business doesn't know how to resource effectively. So this approach of understanding, well, what's the opportunity first, and then providing just enough investment to explore the marketplace effectively, I think is a really important part of this process and really any product management process.
Yeah, I would add in that the business case has to have at least a general description of the product, what you think it's going to be, what you think some of the core functionality is going to be, and the corresponding needs that go with that. But the market needs document really goes in deep into a lot of depth about what's the real need, what's the real problem that's being solved here.
Yeah.
One thing I should mention, the way that we built the optimal product process and the way that we built all of the templates was based on the observation that we'd made over many, many years. 280 Group's been in business for 14 years. We're working with product managers, we found that there oftentimes is a lot of duplication of content and effort across all the different documents. So someone will write a business case, and they'll include market information, and they'll include some of the market needs or all of the market needs, and then they'll go to do the market requirements document or the market needs document, and they'll copy and paste and repeat that. And so the idea behind the optimal product process and the 8 documents is it's a complete holistic set of documents where there's no duplication overall. We also have a document called a master product plan that includes all 8 documents in one document. And you can use that and just go as you go through the 7 phases. All you do is you update it. At each phase, you update whatever's relevant or important for your particular product. And the great thing about that is if you use the master product plan approach, as you go from conceive to plan to develop all the way to retire, you'll have different updated versions of the master product plan. So as a best practice, you can go back and look at, okay, let's do a post-mortem. What were we good at? Was our business case good? Were our forecasts good? Were our market needs accurate? Well, and what do we need to do to get better? If you use that model and you do it across multiple products at your company, that's the way that you can get product management to really achieve that next level of excellence, where go from being sort of an ad hoc group to some real discipline and doing things the right way.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
The other two documents that are critical for product management and in that conceive and plan phase are the roadmap and the market strategy document. The roadmap is important because you have to have a vision of where you want to be, where you want to go with the product. Even if that vision is going to change, you need to be looking out 3 to 5 years and saying, okay, given how technology is changing, given who our competitors are and how competent they are or aren't, given how we're going to fund this, is this, when I look at it strategically, when I look at it from a funding point of view, is this really a product that we know we can win, where 1 year, 3 years, 5 years down the road, we'll be in a very strong position? Because many companies will avoid looking at this, and they end up in a situation where they've invested a lot of money, and they really hadn't been realistic about whether they could own the market. The market strategy document is also really critical, and it's one that we find many companies will not think about until it's too late. For instance, key part of market strategy is, what are your channels going to be? I have a friend who works for a cell carrier, and he's in charge of coming up with innovative new products, and his boss wanted to bring a product to market, and it was a very compelling idea for a product. They could easily build the product.
Shout out to our Twitter participants. Welcome Sarah Donovan, Liz Blank, Erica Anderson, who is underlining that the roadmap is important because you must know strategically where you be 3 to 5 years out.
Well, it's certainly good to see everyone getting on the Twitter stream as well.
B. Figatelix is asking, which are the 8 supporting documents? And I can tweet her. Oh, actually, we didn't get that far yet. That's Veronica Figuarella. So I'll tweet her to be patient and to stay on. And if you could repeat your last remark.
Oh, sure.
We're all really trying really hard to keep up with you on Twitter.
we were talking about the market strategy and the benefits of looking at that and
sure.
Where some people don't use it.
Yeah, so it's really just critical that you think through what your market strategy is going to be before you start spending money and start doing real development. And I just gave an example of a company that created a product or wanted to create a product. But and had they not really looked at market strategy, they wouldn't have realized that there was just no way the product could have been successful because they didn't have a retail channel and it had to be a retail product. So market strategy is really critical, even to the point of how are you going to get your channel interested, excited, more enthused about your product than your competitors, et cetera. So the business case document, market needs document, product description document, roadmap document, and market strategy document. Those are the five key strategy documents for product management. And then on the execution side, there's four other documents. One is beta or early customer plan. Then there's the product launch plan, the marketing plan, and the end of life plan. And it's amazing to me how many companies really fail on, particularly the beta plan and the launch plan. They get in that, you know, if we build it, they will come mentality. And this is particularly true with startups. And as they finally near sort of the light at the end of the tunnel and the product is getting ready to actually come to market, then they start thinking about, oh, well, what are we going to do with customer testing? Are we going to put this in the hands of people? How are we going to launch it? What's it really going to cost? I'll give you an example. One of our clients was a startup, and they'd spent about $3 million to develop a product, and they had some pretty hefty goals in terms of revenues. I think it was $5 million in the first year. And they called us a couple of weeks before they thought they were ready to launch. I mean, literally like 3 or 4 weeks, and said, hey, you know, we're about to finish this product. We want to launch it in 3 weeks. Can you help us? To do a really effective product launch, you need to be thinking months beforehand and really have it planned out. You need to look at your budget and do some realistic calculations about what kind of exposure you're going to get, what kind of leads are going to be driven by that, and what kind of sales you're going to expect. And this company hadn't done anything like that. And their expectation was that they were going to spend $10,000 or $15,000 to launch this product and generate $5 million in revenue the first year. Had they looked at that far earlier in the process, they would have had a much, much more realistic point of view. Same thing with early customers and beta customers. It's so critical to have folks with hands on your product, because otherwise you're sort of in that ivory tower silo and you can't really know how good your product is and whether it's ready to ship. One thing that I do, I always insist on really setting the goals around an early customer program. So if we're going to have 10 early customers using the product extensively, you know, I'm going to insist that 7 or 8 at least tell us definitively that the product is ready to ship. So again, if you'd like to read more about the 8 documents and the optimal product process, you can go to the 280group.com, and under the services menu, the bottom menu item is optimal product process. And you can download my book, Optimal Product Process, for free, and there's a webinar where you can watch that explains all 7 phases and all of the 8 documents.
Brian, we've got question number 2 is, which phases are most often overlooked or ignored in companies?
I'll kind of go through each phase. So the conceive phase is very oftentimes it's not overlooked, but it's not something that's done consciously. People are coming up with ideas. You'll have different people pitching them with different business cases and different numbers and trying to sort of becomes he who screams loudest gets their product funded. Mm-hmm. Which is very different than an environment where you say, okay, we have a specific way of coming up with great ideas and prioritizing them, and we encourage people to do that, and here's the process. It doesn't have to be a heavyweight, really lengthy, extensive process, but you at least want to have a way to look at different projects and different products and evaluate them with some prioritization criteria quickly and easily. So conceive is oftentimes present, but not people aren't necessarily conscious of it. The plan phase is many times in engineering-driven companies, the plan phase is it'll be acknowledged with sort of lip service, but you'll find that the engineers will oftentimes develop a good portion of the product before management actually funds product management coming in and telling engineering what the market needs are. That's one of the ways you end up building technology for technology's sake. In some cases, the engineers have great ideas and they're onto something. And in other cases, I've seen lots and lots of times where product manager had to go back and look and really justify, is there really a need for this particular feature? Most companies have developed very thoroughly. They pay a lot of attention to it. They pay some attention to qualify, and it just depends on the company. Inevitably, like with a software product, inevitably the schedule will get squeezed, and usually what suffers is the actual qualification and QA work and, again, putting it into customers' hands. Launch is, it's just dependent on the company. There are some companies that are just brilliant at launching products. They have a launch department. I learned to launch products at Apple Computer, and mm-hmm. we had a launch. There was a whole checklist and launch process. So when you were going to launch a product, you notified them 4 months in advance, and they took you through the whole thing, and they worked it like clockwork. And, you know, there's certainly an example of a company that's great at it. There are many companies where there is no formal launch process and where each time a product is launched, the company ends up reinventing the wheel. And there's a bunch of downsides to that. You know, the first one being your launches aren't nearly as effective. And number two, the probability of missing something that could have been really leveraged is very, very high.
I've always been impressed with the Apple approach to launches for a product to be announced on stage at a developer conference, and then the following day or even by the end of the conference or even the end of the talk, for that product to then be available on the websites around the world, I think is a phenomenal amount of coordination that certainly doesn't happen by accident.
That's a great example of where a lot of companies fall down. They'll plan out a big launch, they'll get people really excited, but they'll do it before the product's actually available for sale. So the people are excited.
Yeah.
By the time the product's available several weeks later, they don't even remember it and don't buy it.
Yep.
Marketing is an interesting one because some companies are great at marketing and they really have it down. Many technology companies just don't have good marketing. And then retire is a phase where I haven't seen a lot of companies that are really good at it. The ones that are companies that come to mind might be someone like Microsoft, where, you know, when they retire a version of Windows, they're really clear, or they try to be really clear. They're not always perfect, but they're pretty clear about, especially for their enterprise customers, about here's how long we're going to support this product. You're warned well beforehand to test and, you know, decide what you want to do in terms of upgrading, et cetera. I think they do a pretty good job of it. For enterprise software companies, it's particularly important because the product cycles are so long, and really if you anger your customers, you can really damage your brand.
Look, Brian, I had a question for you that I guess relates to some of our experiences here in Australia as well. Sort of relates to the question four, sort of skipping ahead a little bit, which is how does innovation come to play in the process? And my question with this is, that quite often we get pushback when we say, look, we've got a product management process that works, and organizations say, well, look, that's great, but we need to innovate quickly and more effectively. How does a formal process work with innovation?
Well, that's one of the things about the optimal product process that we tried to design into it. It is designed so that you can fit it into any type of cultural environment, team environment, and sort of any environment for needs. So, for example, if you're Adobe and you're launching Creative Suite and you have 8 different products that are all intertwined and some of them share technologies and they all have to have a consistent user interface and all kinds of teams are dependent on other people, then you might want a pretty heavyweight product process where you really document things, you really get signature, you know, sign off and commitment up front. Then on the flip side, kind of like what I mentioned with their innovation program, you can go through the phases very, very rapidly. There's nothing that says it has to be a cumbersome process. In many companies, if you put together a product council and you give them the authority to grant or restrict budget, you then put together very simple, business case can literally be 10 PowerPoint slides. Should we proceed with this? Do you think it's a good idea? But the word process tends to have negative connotations for a lot of people because it implies lots of unnecessary busy work. And what we try to do at the 280 Group is when we help companies with process, we try to put in the lightest weight possible process that will work in that particular company. You know, for startups, for instance, you know, you want to be able to move fast, you want to be innovative, but at the same time, you don't want to run off and start writing checks for things that you haven't actually sat down and thought through the critical questions for, because otherwise your funding may run out and you may just end up just starting to develop a product that wasn't viable to begin with.
Q3, which was how do the roles of product management and product marketing fit into the standard product process?
The really simple way to look at it is product management is generally involved in the upfront portion, so in the conceive, plan, develop, qualify phases. And they're bringing together ideas. Oftentimes, product marketing will be giving them feedback from the market and good ideas, but they're bringing together ideas from all of the different sources and doing the strategy, doing the strategic thinking, doing the product planning, and, again, trying to create a great product that both strategically and financially is going to meet the company's goals. So they're on the front end of the process, the first four of the phases. And product marketing tends to be on the last three. So as the product's being qualified, product marketing then comes in and figures out how to launch the product, how to position it really effectively, how to price it, what the unique selling proposition is going to be, what the core features and benefits are, how you're going to get the channel excited or customers excited, and then how you're going to market the product, and then eventually if you're going to retire the product and or if you're going to retire it and come out with a new version. So product management is sort of on the first half of the optimal product process, and product marketing is on the second half.
So the question is, in a small organization where there aren't the resources separating product management and product marketing, I'm thinking about in startups, is this applicable to them?
Absolutely. And what you'll find in startups is usually you have one person who does both product management and product marketing. And curiously, you'll find that in big companies, too. The boundaries around what is product management, what is product marketing, and who should be called what, there hasn't traditionally been any standardization. That's actually one of the reasons why the AIPMM work on the seven-phase product lifecycle is so important, because we're trying to get to a standard that everyone can agree on. So that's sort of the basis of who does what. I'd highly encourage everyone to look in our white paper section under resources on our website. There's a white paper that I wrote called Product Management versus Product Marketing, and it explains the differences between the two different roles. It's sort of the most common way it's set up. But I will say one of the challenges with having one person do all of the responsibilities is it's very difficult to find people who can do both extremely well. What you'll find is there are really good product managers. They tend to be very technical. They tend to be very analytical. They're great with the engineers. And there are really good product marketers, people who can go out and get the world excited about the product and who are really excellent communicators. And then occasionally you'll find someone who can truly do both. If you're at a startup and you're going to have someone doing both roles, you really want to get someone who's been there and done it and who's very, very experienced. Our staff of consultants is a good example. A good portion of them are really excellent at product management, but just not that good at product marketing. On the flip side, there are some really excellent product marketing people who just have no desire or, you know, really strong skills in product management. And then there's also a core group of us, I think myself included, who've done both roles very effectively and are very comfortable doing it. But in a startup, the risk you run is, if you hire somebody who's on the product management side too strong or the product marketing side too strong, you better look at all seven phases and make sure you've got everything being covered. Because if you miss something on the left-hand side, you're going to build a product that doesn't meet customer needs. And if you miss something on the right-hand side later in the cycle, you may build the greatest product in the world, but you aren't necessarily going to be able to message it and launch it and be effective in terms of driving sales.
Great. Some questions out on Twitter. So Veronica was asking, what is the standard product process? Is it Waterfall? Is it Agile? Is it R. Cooper?
The URL is on 280group.com under the services menu. If you go to the bottom menu item, it's optimal product process. And it explains all about how it fits into both Waterfall and Agile. The idea behind Agile in terms of how it fits in is, you're still doing all seven phases. You're just simply doing some of them more often and more rapidly. And the idea, and going from one phase to the next generally requires far less documentation and far fewer people to make the decision. So, for instance, if you're doing an agile software product and you've got a release out, you go back to the conceive phase and you generate ideas very rapidly, and you look at the user stories and you look at the product backlog, and you prioritize it very quickly, And usually there's not a huge group of people who are invested in it. And then you don't even document many of the features. You sit down and have a good conversation with your engineers. Here's what the customer is trying to accomplish. You make sure you understand each other. They go off, start coding in parallel. The use cases or the QA cases are written, and you go through a sprint, and you've just gone through the first four phases of the cycle very rapidly. And you may go back through that cycle several times before you launch, or you may be ready to launch after just one sprint. But the idea behind the optimal product process is it's really designed to be sort of a framework for allowing for both waterfall and agile, depending on what's going to work best for your particular company.
Excellent.
We certainly agree with your comments there, Brian, that innovation is not randomly throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. It's not randomly launching stuff to the marketplace to see what's successful. For us, innovation is a designed process in itself, and it doesn't have to be laborious, and it doesn't have to be overly detailed, but it does need to seek out and provide solutions to important market needs in the marketplace.
Yeah, there are a number of innovation techniques that we teach that, you know, in many cases they're not complicated. There's the idea of buy a feature, which is a way where you get your customers together, you show them the features you're thinking about doing, and you give them each $100 in play money, and they each get to spend their money on features. That's a great way to prioritize, and if you have some innovative ideas, you can put them on the list and get a customer reaction really quickly. But there's lots of really powerful techniques, and I think you're right, it doesn't have to be a laborious process.
Excellent. So why don't we go to question 5, which this is what Veronica was asking earlier. What corresponding documents are recommended as best practices to follow the process? If you're going to go through each document, you're going to have to go slow so we can so we can document those documents.
Sure. So the most important, the documents that are important are first the business case. And the business case is really looking at, is this a viable product from a profitability point of view and or a strategic point of view for our particular company? And you're going to want to look at what would the product do, what needs would it solve, how would we fare against competition, does it fit with who our company is and what our core competencies are, and also you want a rough idea of the numbers. So that's the first one. The second one, it would be the market needs document or market requirements document, and it includes personas, it includes use cases, and includes what the actual customer needs are. What problems do they have? What are you trying to solve with that particular product? And it's designed so that you can give it to an engineer and they'll understand what the product is, but you won't necessarily be telling them what the solution is. Because oftentimes, if you have really great engineers, if you tell them the problem, they'll come up with a far better solution than you could ever possibly think up on your own. The response to the market needs document is called a product description or document or a product requirements document. And what it does is it says at a feature level, here is the feature that's going to map back to that particular need, and here's how we're going to solve that problem. Not a technical specification, which oftentimes the engineers will then take the product description and write an in-depth technical spec, which says, you know, here's how we're going to write it, here's the APIs we're going to use, here's the core technology we're going to use, here's what the performance is, et cetera. But it's really a description of, okay, here's the feature that's going to meet that need that was outlined in the market needs document. The other two key strategic documents out of the 8 are the product roadmap. And the roadmap simply shows what you think the releases are going to look like over time. And there's a bunch of different ways to create a roadmap. We actually have a product roadmap toolkit that teaches you all of the different ways. And my book, Expert Product Management, talks about it. But whether you use the idea of themes or golden features, or you use a technique called Kano analysis, or you use some combination, what you want to do is sketch out for your roadmap, sketch out, first thing off, what's your vision? Where's the product going to be pretty far out in the future? And then the roadmap should show you how you're going to get there. So what's release 1, and does it have the minimum viable feature set to release it. And then based on that, okay, what do we think release 2, release 3, release 4 are going to look like? The other important strategic document we talked about is called the market strategy document, and it outlines how are you going to enter the market, what channels are you going to use, what's your unique selling proposition going to be, what's your positioning going to be, what are you going to do in terms of pricing strategy. And it's really critical to look at that document, as I said earlier, because if you're an enterprise software company and you're trying to come out with a consumer product that's going to require distribution and a retail channel presence, you'd better think through the market strategy extremely carefully before you spend any money. So those are the five strategic ones. The four tactical ones, or the four tactical ones, are the beta program plan and or early customer plan. And that outlines how many customers you're actually going to put the product into their hands, what you're going to ask them to do with it, what the goals are, what do you constitute to be success, how are you going to know that the product is ready to ship. So it's very critical in terms of getting that real-world validation as to whether your product is really truly ready to go out to the masses. Following the beta program plan is the product launch plan. And the launch plan reaffirms what your initial thinking was and adjusts it initially from the early phases of planning. And it says, okay, what's the final positioning and unique selling proposition? What kind of vehicles are we going to use to reach which target market? What kind of budget are we going to spend? And a good launch plan will then say, well, given the budget that we're using, how many people are we going to reach and what kind of ROI, and have some actual ROI calculations in there, what kind of return on investment could we expect to get? Following the launch plan is the marketing plan. And sometimes product marketing is responsible for this. Oftentimes product management and product marketing are influencing the actual marketing department. And the marketing plan covers, you know, what kind of ongoing marketing programs are we going to use? Are we going to use online AdWords advertising? Are we going to do trade shows? Are we going to do a press tour or ongoing press activities to get visibility? Are we going to do direct mail campaigns or email campaigns? And the marketing plan is critical because as you look out at the long-term forecast for the product, you have to be very realistic about, given the amount of energy and time and money that you're spending, are you going to be able to really hit the numbers and continuously hit the numbers you need to in order to make the revenue that you're looking for.
Question list here, how can I implement this process at my company to improve our product management? But I guess if people could do one thing to sort of kick off the process within their own organizations, if a product management process doesn't exist there, what might be the best bang for buck? Where can they get the most benefit for their organization?
The best thing that you can do is put together a presentation that talks about how great companies do product management and what the benefits are going to be for everyone involved. We have a presentation like that at the 280 Group, and if you email me at contact@280group.com, I'll send you a copy. It's designed to really talk about why you need a process and the fact that the process can be incredibly lightweight, but you need to be thinking through everything, number one. And then it also talks about what are the benefits. If your engineers understand, hey, if we have this simple process, then I'm not going to have feature requests coming in from, you know, from executives and sales guys and so on randomly. And your sales guys are going to understand, this is going to give me a much more predictable date that I can actually rely on as to when the product's going to be available and what's going to be in it. And what you want to do is pitch the peers and director level, then you also really want to get the executives involved. And talk about great companies like Apple and Hewlett-Packard and Adobe and Cisco and a whole bunch of others, you know, have really honed this to a science. And if your company wants to grow, that's probably the key breaking point, is you get to a certain number of people, and if you don't have some kind of process in place, you'll simply stagnate. You can't get past that because no one can communicate what they're doing to all the other people. So if you want a copy of the presentation, again, just email me, contact@280group.com.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Nick. The time has gotten really fast. We've had some great participation. Usually we just get to the tip of the iceberg. You were going in pretty deep. I want to invite people to come to two webinars this week. One is tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on Overhaul Your User Interface Without Upsetting Users. It's a webinar that Brian is giving, sponsored by the AIPMM, with Macadamian User Experience. Very important if you're working with web products. How to overhaul your user interface without upsetting the users, which is not always done well. Also on Wednesday, a very exciting webinar on European Product Management Certification, given by Brian, sponsored by the AIPMM, talking about how product management is different in Europe than from the United States, and how European product managers can advance their career and education. Thank you very much again to Brian at the 280 Group. As mentioned at the beginning, I will look at the Twitter stats, and people who participated on Twitter will receive one of the copies of Brian's books, either Expert Product Management, The Phenomenal Product Manager, 42 Rules of Product Management, Optimal Product Process, Lean Product Management, Agile Product Management Excellence, and 42 Rules of Product Marketing. By the way, both Nick and I have contributed to the 42 Rules book. Also posted in the links are the download for the Optimal Product Process. Again, thank you, Nick, for joining us. Thank you, Brian Lawley.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. This is Cindy F. Solomon. Please join us next week. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Nick. Thank you to our participants.
Thank you very much.